Hi, my name is Sansara Taylor, and I'm here with Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, sitting down with Carl Dix to get into a number of things. Carl Dix is someone who has deep roots in the struggle for revolution and the emancipation of humanity. He's somebody who came of age in the 1960s, was drafted to go to Vietnam, and did a righteous and heroic thing. He refused to serve in Vietnam. He served 2 years in Leavenworth military prison for refusing to go out and carry out war crimes. And as soon as he got out of prison, he actually dove deeper into the struggle, got connected up with the movement for black liberation, and through that connected up much more deeply and became a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Since that time, he has never turned back, and it would take a long time to get into everything that he's done, but most recently he's been making headlines and making waves for spearheading a movement to stop mass incarcerations, to stop the slow genocide of mass incarceration, to lead a movement of civil disobedience against stop and frisk as part of that, and to do all of this as part of building a movement for real revolution, to get rid of this system at the soonest possible time and bring into being a far better world. It's a great pleasure and a great honor to sit down with you, Carl. Thanks for joining me.
Well, I'm really glad for the opportunity to do this interview and get into the important discussion of the important questions that we're going to do today.
Okay. So there's a lot of things that I want to cover that I think our readers and listeners will want to hear about. From the recent developments this summer around the massive outpourings against the acquittal of George Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin, stuff around the heroic hunger strike of prisoners in California against solitary confinement and torture in the prisons, elements of building the movement for revolution, the campaign to get BA, Bob Avakian, the leader of this revolution, known throughout society, the upcoming major day of protest, which really needs to be a, and I know you're burning to talk about this too, a major day of struggle, October 22nd, a national day of protest to stop police brutality and the criminalization of a generation. And so there's a number of things. But first, I want to take you back and I want to ask you, on the day that the verdict came down, on the day that George Zimmerman was acquitted for the murder of Trayvon Martin, how did you feel?
I guess on the day, it felt like a kick in the gut. You know, like, here it is 2013, 60 years after the lynching of Emmett Till, by a couple of white men who decided that this 14-year-old black kid had gotten out of his place and beat him viciously and killed him and then threw his body into the river. And when it was found out that they did this, they got put on trial and let walk free. And then days after getting out of court, they sold their story to Look magazine, talking about how they had murdered Emmett Till, but were able to walk away from that. And then it took me back to even before the Civil War in this country, back to the Dred Scott decision, which was a decision that the U.S. Supreme Court made, I think it was in 1857, in the case of this black man who had escaped from slavery and was brought back into court by his former owner. And in this case, the Supreme Court literally said that black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. And then we're up to 2013, and we have a situation where this wannabe cop vigilante sees a black youth walking, talking on the telephone with iced tea and Skittles. Decides he's a criminal, stalks him, confronts him, and shoots him dead. And then the system says, no crime committed here. They were saying again, more than 150 years after the Dred Scott decision, that black people have no rights, that white people are bound to respect. And that's how that made me feel at that point. you know. Now, the day after, I was heartened. I was heartened by the fact that large numbers of people all across the country responded in outrage to that verdict. It was black people, it was Latinos, it was also a number of white people involved in this. People out in Los Angeles marched on to the highway, Interstate 10, and stopped it, blocked it. That's how mad they were. They went out on that highway and they were going to show, no, no more of this. We can't take this. New York City, people in the thousands marched into Times Square and said it, shut it down. And then in cities all across the country, people were responding in similar ways. And to look at and listen to what people had to say at these, you saw black parents there with their children in tears, hugging them and saying, how can I tell my children about this? And what does this mean for them? And what does it mean for us that this vigilante can murder a black youth and get away? What are they telling us? What are they telling us about the nature of America? What does this mean? There were a lot of people speaking like that, speaking in tears about it. There were white people who came out to it and who said, look, I do not want to be a part of an America that says that it's okay to do that. These were people who had like kind of forced to look at some very big questions. Questions about the nature of this society, the nature of America. Questions about why do these things happen again and again and again? Because a big part of the reason why this hit people this way, there's both the stark horror of what happened to Trayvon, but the fact that things like this happen again and again in this society. Police all across the country brutalize and even murder black and Latino youth and almost always get away with it. The standard approach of law enforcement is to treat black and brown youth like they're guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. And in many, many cases, our youth don't survive to prove their innocence. They're treated like a class of permanent suspects. And this verdict in this case brought all of that together for people. And that's why people were up against this thing of, what does this say about America? Why does this happen again and again? And do I want to be a part of a society where this can happen and then the system says it's okay? And see, this is very, very important, because when people are grappling with this kinds of questions is when we can make the biggest advances and make leaps in bringing to people the way out of this mess. Because things don't have to be this way. We don't have to continually watch parents burying children who have been murdered by the police, and their cop murderers walk the streets scot-free, still with a badge and a gun, and in position to maybe brutalize or murder somebody else's kids. We don't have to continue to face outrages like this or the many, many other horrors that come down on people because of this system. The violence against women, the wars for empire, the drone strikes, the massive government spying, the way the very environment of the planet is being ravaged. All of this could be ended through revolution, communist revolution. This is not only needed, but it's possible. And there's leadership for this revolution in Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the new understanding or new synthesis of communism that he's brought forward. So this is a time when we need to be really accelerating our efforts to bring to people that things don't have to be this way, that this horrible world could be transformed through revolution and nothing less than that, and to bring to people the leadership that we have for this revolution, and also the plan and strategy that the Revolutionary Communist Party has developed for making this revolution, and the vision of the kind of society that could be brought into being after the revolution. And all of these things are things that people need to get into. We need to be bringing to people. And, you know, people need to be going to the website, revcom.us, and looking up these things and digging into them and engaging them.
Well, a minute ago you said, you know, a lot of people, all kinds of people, but you mentioned white people in particular, were mm-hmm. asking, in the wake of this verdict, what kind of a country is this? What is it about America? And then after that happened, then Obama got out, he gave his statement about what it's like to be a black man in America, being profiled, being, you know, women clutching their purses, all this sort of thing. A lot of people were speaking to what, well, you know, yeah, this country has some problems, but it's on a trajectory. These problems are being improved. They're being worked on. We're advancing. We still have a long ways to go, but we've come a long ways. And so what would you say to people who were asking that question? Because on the one hand, you do have the things that you're describing. You have the mass incarceration. I want to talk more about that as we go forward. We have the police brutality. You have the things that you're describing, but you also have a black president.
Mm-hmm.
You also have, you know, I think this is confusing to people, so I maybe you can cut through some of that.
Okay, that's actually a very good question. Because if you look at the situation today, you do have opportunities for sections of black people. Things have opened up. Black people have gotten into positions of influence, gotten into college, off of that gotten into professions, and, you know, political positions, including we got a black president today. So that is a part of the reality. But then we also have to look at, as that has happened and as that's developing, we also have a situation where for millions and millions of people in the inner cities of this country, and especially very intensively for the youth, there is no future in this society and in this system. And this is not the fault of the people in the inner cities, that they don't work hard enough, that the parents don't make the kids do enough homework, that the young men don't pull their pants up, or that the young women are having babies out of wedlock, which is all too often the way this stuff gets discussed. It is the result of the very way this system operates, this capitalist imperialist system operates. Because you had a situation when black people migrated from the rural south, from the plantations they'd be on, they migrated into the cities and became part of the workforce in the factories. The bottom tier of the workforce, working the hardest, lowest paying, most dangerous jobs, but they were in part of that workforce. And people were looking towards, well, does this mean we can continue to go farther in advance? And while a few did, what actually happened is, with globalization, the internationalization of production, you saw a lot of those factories being moved out of the inner cities and then moved out of the United States to halfway around the world, to places where they could find somebody who they could make work those jobs for much less pay, in much more dangerous conditions, and through that increase the profits of the handful of capitalists who owned and controlled those factories. But that left millions and millions of black people, and later joined by millions and millions of Latinos, in the inner cities, growing up facing futures of hopelessness. The ways in which to survive and raise families had been sucked out of the ghettos and barrios across the country. The educational system in the inner cities had been wrecked and geared towards failing the youth. And that has a lot of young people growing up facing what choices for the future. You can look for a minimum wage job, but with the way the economy has developed and a lot of people who had more stable jobs being knocked down and being brought into the workforce on a lower level, those minimum wage jobs aren't even there for everybody. So then you're left with, do I join the military and become a killing machine for this system in some of the wars for empire that it's waging around the world? Or do I find some hustle to survive, legal or illegal? And you do have a lot of our youth who are into crime and drugs, who are fighting each other and even killing each other. But all of this has developed because of the very operation of the capitalist system, together with conscious policies that the people who run the system have taken. Policies that have emphasized and brought forward wars on crime, wars on drugs, which are fundamentally wars on poor people, on black people, and on Latinos. And that's where we have the mass incarceration that has more than 2 million people warehoused in prisons across the country. A lot of them are in there for drugs and, you know, just drug possession. That's what we have. We have a lot of people who are in that situation. People who, when they get out of prison, find it even harder to find work, aren't allowed to get government loans. They're banned from getting government loans, so they can't go back to school or start a business or anything like that. They're not even allowed to live in public housing. And in many states, they can't even vote. So you're in a trajectory where it's even harder to make it after you've been in prison. And that's what millions and millions of people in the inner city are directly facing, and then millions more are tied to people who are facing that. Because when you send a man or a woman into prison, you actually take the hearts and the lives of their loved ones are caught up into that incarceration thing too. So that's what we're dealing with, and that's the backdrop to it. The actual operation of this system and the conscious policies that the ruling class has adopted in relation to the contradictions that it faces from the operation of the system. And yes, it has provided some opportunities, and then it uses those people who do make gains and get positions in order to help keep those who are being ground down by the system in line. And we see that, and it's at its height with Obama. That's why Bob Avakian called him a trump card for the imperialist rulers, because he can come out and say, okay, it's bad, and I know it's bad, and I've experienced some of it too. I've been followed in a store and this kind of stuff. But you got people like me who are in position now, in positions of power and influence, and we can work on this and we can continually make it better. So that's the way we should go at it. And they're working to try to keep people having faith in this system. The problem that they got is the reality, though. The reality of a verdict like the Trayvon verdict, where you have the system saying, you got no rights in this setup. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to take the people who've been jolted by that and bring them back into the fold, you know, through using Obama, through using Eric Holder, the attorney general who makes him the head law enforcement person in the country, and having him come out and make statements. But that's what they're actually doing. They're trying to work to get people who are losing faith in the system, questioning the system, and trying to get them to come back in, to give the system another try.
Okay. So, I mean, they're using Obama, but Obama's also very consciously part of this.
Oh, yeah, he's like the president. I mean, it's not like he is someone who is being taken in or against his will forced. He's the commander-in-chief of the U.S. global empire and is working to keep that empire in effect, including here in this country, keeping that empire and its domination and the people in the country drawn into the framework of the system. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. In the, you know, when we began, you went through the history of this country from mm-hmm. slavery to Jim Crow to today with the new Jim Crow. And one of the things that you've been emphasizing a lot is that we are now confronting with this, which you spoke some to just now, but the whole, you know, the whole epidemic of mass incarceration, which is grinding up millions and millions and millions of lives. And it's the snatching of the youth, it's the stealing of people's fathers, it's the hugest rate of women incarcerated anywhere in the world. And then it's all the networks of people who are connected to them, predominantly Black and Latino, but other, you know, all the networks connected to them. And then the conditions in prison, too, which I think, you know, maybe you want to speak to. Because I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of people who've been through it don't really want to go there and talk about it. And a lot of people who haven't been through it, they just don't know anything about what actually goes on in these prisons. But you've described all this as a slow genocide. And I think it'd be helpful if you talk about, you know, I don't get the impression you say that just for rhetorical flourish. I mean, you mean that. And I think it's a true statement that we're facing a slow genocide. Why is that true? And what does that actually mean? What are the conditions of that for people to understand?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question. Because, look, we revolutionary communists, we try to speak to what is the objective reality, what is true. Not what can we say to hype people up and get them to do what we might want them to do. We have to actually bring to them what the reality is and to help them understand that reality and how it's being driven, but also how we can transform that reality. And that's why we developed this understanding of, that's how we came to, let's look at this thing of mass incarceration. What is it? Why does it happen? What's driving it? And where is it headed unless we stop it in the only way that's really possible, through making revolution? And that's where we came to the understanding that mass incarceration is like a slow genocide that could easily become a fast one. Because look, what genocide is it's not only what happened in Nazi Germany. Because, you know, a lot of people understand genocide as when they start lining people up against the wall and shooting them or gassing them in the ovens. And that was the last stage of the genocide in Nazi Germany. But there's a process to get to that. There's a process of identifying a grouping of people, demonizing them, segregating them. See, and these are all things that have already happened in this country, and that's part of the process that we're going through. And then when you take hundreds of thousands of people from a particular group, you warehouse them in prison, then when they get out, they are treated like second-class citizens and have little to no opportunity to survive and have a decent life. And the actual definition of genocide internationally from the United Nations is putting a grouping of people in whole or in part in conditions that make it impossible for them to survive and thrive as a people. And that's actually what's happening with Blacks and Latinos throughout the inner cities of this country. Sections of a whole people who are being put in situations that make it impossible for them to survive and thrive. And that's what we're dealing with. And why do we say that it's a slow genocide? Well, because it's not yet at the point where people are being put up against the walls and shot massively. Although a number of people are being, a lot of people are being shot down by the enforcers, the police, the immigration and naturalization, INS's, La Migra is gunning people down. So this is happening, but it's not happening on a massive scale yet. But it could easily change. I mean, just in the last few days, this Tea Party Senator, Ted Cruz from Texas, went to a commemoration of Jesse Helms, a former senator from North Carolina, and he made the statement, repeating something that was said a few decades ago by John Wayne, that we need 100 Jesse Helmses, which means but we need a whole Senate full of Jesse Helmses. Well, Jesse Helms was a racist, woman-hating, gay-hating, reactionary, fascist-type force who was in the Senate for decades. I mean, this man, I don't know that he was in the Ku Klux Klan, but the only thing he was missing was the hood, because he had all of the political positions and the outlook that the Klan stood for. The vicious, brutal suppression of Black people, the subjugation of women to subordinate places in society and to, you know, getting rid of gay people. He stood for all of that, and he acted on that in Congress throughout his career there. And to say today we need 100 Jesse Helmses is to say that we need to go back to that. We need to accelerate the reactionary moves that are coming down, the fascistic moves that are coming down. And that's where things need to go. And things are, in fact, going that way. We can't ignore the actual steps towards that. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court took up some cases. They took up a case on affirmative action and, you know, cut the legs out of that. They took up a case on the Voting Rights Act from the 1960s that made it possible for black people in the southeastern U.S. to gain the right to vote back in the 1960s. Supreme Court gutted the heart out of one section of the Voting Rights Act, which was the key section that allowed people to vote, because it took the ability to determine whether laws could be passed and restrictions made on people's right to vote out of the states that were restricting people's right to vote. Well, Supreme Court says we don't need to do that anymore. That was then, this is now. Within days, states across the country had begun to pass restriction after restriction on the right to vote, and restrictions that openly were targeting black people and Latinos. So there is a powerful move to take things back in that direction and to institute very horrific fascistic moves. And that's why I say we're talking about a slow genocide that could easily become a fast one. And again, this isn't just because some reactionary fools have gotten close to the seat of power. It has to do with the very way that the capitalist imperialist system is operating, and in particular what I was talking about before, about the in the inner cities, millions and millions of youth facing futures in the system where there's no hope for the future. Lack of ways to survive and raise families, educational system, you know, geared to fail you, and that leaves a lot of the youth having to come up with some hustle, legal or illegal, to survive. And they have developed mass incarceration as a way to deal with that. And that's something that, look, if that's not taken on, this could be taken in an even more. It's not just that it would stay as bad as it is now, which is unacceptable and horrible, but it could be rapidly taken to even worse conditions. And that's part of what people have to be thinking about when they're grappling with the nature of this society. What is America? Why does this injustice happen again and again and again? And what can and must be done about it? Because what we're saying to people is, first off, it ain't realistic to say that things will stay like this and then we can make some surface changes for the better within it. Things are being rapidly pulled in a much worse direction, but it is possible to get out of this through revolution.